I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's here and now. Just a day after President Obama signed the sweeping financial overhaul bill, the debate is raging over who will lead the powerful new agency created by the measure. The Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection will oversee new regulations for the financial products used by millions of Americans. Wall Street Journal reporter Damian Paletta joins us to talk about who's on the short list. Welcome, Damian.
Thanks so much.
Can you first off explain what this new regulatory agency eventually will do?
Sure. So after the Great Depression, the government created the SEC and the FDIC to protect depositors and investors. After this most recent financial crisis, the government's created a new agency to protect consumers from financial products, everything from mortgages to credit cards, student loans to payday loans. So it's going to have wide discretion to write rules and enforce policies against pretty much any financial company that offers products to consumers.
That's huge.
It's really unprecedented, and that's why it's created so much controversy. There was a lot of push and pull during the debate on whether to create the new agency, and now that the new agency has been created or been authorized by law, there's going to be a big lobbying effort on all sides about who should run it and how it should be run.
And that's already started, and one of the first names that's been talked about, and really someone who, if you believe some accounts, may have thought up the whole idea of this consumer financial protection agency is Elizabeth Warren.
That's right. It was really interesting. I went to the bill signing yesterday where the president signed the bill into law, and there was a whole ceremony. There's about 400 people there. But they saved a seat for Elizabeth Warren, who's a Harvard law professor, right in the front row, right in the center, next to Paul Volcker, the former Federal Reserve chairman. She was treated like a celebrity. You know, a lot of lawmakers wanted their pictures taken with her and stuff. It was just kind of a weird experience. You had folks like Ben Bernanke and others off to the side, and they saved the spot in the middle for Elizabeth Warren. Democrats are making a strong public push for Elizabeth Warren. It's really unusual for folks to preemptively try to push a candidate for a job, but that's what we're seeing. The liberal groups and the unions are really pushing for her to get this job, too. There's some concern from centrist Democrats and a lot of Republicans that she's too much of an activist, that she's going to push for too many restrictions on lending, and that could end up hurting the recovery. But right now, she's got this star status in Washington.
And then there are also some questions about what her relationship might be with Treasury Secretary Geithner.
That's right. And that's something that's been really kind of hard to follow because she has been put in charge of this congressional oversight panel that's tasked with watching and monitoring the $700 billion, bailout from 2 years ago. So what her job has been essentially is to have the Treasury Secretary up on the Hill every so often and kind of pound on him, criticizing the different programs. And that's
always makes for a good relationship.
Exactly. And so it's been kind of fun to watch, but anyone can understand how, that might not always be taken the right way. And, Geithner has said nothing but nice things about Elizabeth Warren in the last week. There's another candidate for the consumer protection job, Michael Barr, who's a senior official at the Treasury Department. Michael Barr and Tim Geithner are very close. They worked really closely together on the financial overhaul bill. So it's thought that maybe Geithner would prefer Michael Barr because they worked so closely together in the last year. But ultimately, the decision will be President Obama's.
Of course, there's another possibility, and that's Gene Kimmelman from the Justice Department.
That's right. Gene Kimmelman is someone who's been in Washington a long time. He's worked on these issues. He's joined the Obama administration last year. He's lesser known, but he's definitely one that many consider a candidate, and he's been listed as one of the three finalists.
Now, the person who runs this agency really will shape it and will really decide the direction of how this goes, which really means a lot about credit to virtually every American.
That's right. The first director of this agency is going to be able to make all sorts of decisions. They're going to be in charge of having to write, mortgage disclosures. What are new mortgage rules going to be? How easy is it going to be? And how simple is it going to be for someone to get a loan and to prevent a lot of those tricky fees that folks think help lead to the mortgage crisis? They're going to have discretion to decide which types of companies should fall under their jurisdiction, what types of fees or penalties should be levied against companies that break the new rules. There's going to be a lot of influence over how this new agency is set up. And this is a 5-year appointment, so they'll be around for a long time.
Damian Paletta, financial reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Deb.
This month, authorities in Syria quietly banned the niqab at public universities. The Minister of Higher Education said the full veil, which some Muslim women wear on campus, runs counter to academic values and the traditions of Syrian universities. Several European countries are debating bans on Islamic veils. In France, lawmakers moved closer to adopting a ban. Supporters there say the veils cut off the women behind them from society. But opponents say the bans are an assault on religious freedom. Today, we want to talk about life behind the veil with two women. By the way, for pictures of Islamic veils, go to our website, hereandnow.org. We begin with Hiba Ahmed, an American of Egyptian descent who lives outside Albuquerque, New Mexico, with her husband and two children. She's a trained mechanical engineer, and she's been wearing a niqab for about 8 years. I asked her to describe it for us.
A lot of people think that the name is burqa, and actually burqa is very specific to the Afghanistan region, and I've never worn one. So it's very different from the niqab. And the niqab is actually the specific name of a veil that covers the face except for the eyes. So if you were to see me in public, I wear what's called a abaya. Abaya is a long flowing dress that's loose on the body. And then I wear a khimar. A khimar is a, it's like a headscarf that comes down to my fingertips. And then I also wear a face veil or a niqab. And again, that covers my entire face except for my eyes.
And you didn't always wear this. You went to college, got your master's degree. What made you decide to wear the niqab?
When I was in graduate school, actually my husband, who was raised as a Methodist, he started to study Islam, and he started asking me questions that I really couldn't answer. And so it pushed me onto my own spiritual journey, and I started to really question my life purpose. At the time, I was working for an oil company, and I was very much about, you know, my career. And then after September 11th, the work environment really changed. You know, it became very polarizing. I started to hear in the media that many Muslim women were taking their scarves off out of fear. And it really upset me because I thought, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to do what we believe is the right thing. And it really also, the work environment helped to make sense of modesty for me. And what I mean by that is, being a mechanical engineer, I was one of a few women working there. And there was such a sexualized environment there and everywhere, really. If you look at magazines, women's bodies are used to market movies. And I really saw that no matter how much I accomplished in my workplace, they always brought me back to my physical body. And so covering was very appealing to me at that time.
It must have been difficult, though, to go from somebody who was actually dressing in a completely Western way to then wearing this at the office as a mechanical engineer.
I wore the headscarf to work, and then 6 months later is when I started to wear niqab. I actually decided to quit my job. My interest started to be more towards volunteerism and wanting to help in a more social activist way. And so actually the day I quit my job is the day I started wearing the niqab. Because I was working in labs, it was just not practical at all to be at work with the niqab on. But, you know, honestly, I gained so much from wearing the niqab. I became so much more self-confident because I knew that I wasn't going to fit in. So I stopped trying. I didn't care anymore if I wore the latest styles or, you know, if my hair was done a certain way. It was more about what I thought about myself and what God thought about me. And then it also challenged me to a higher moral code because everybody is judging Islam based on how I behave.
I read a criticism, and one of them was wearing the niqab just means really that women are saying that they need to be hidden to prove their worth. What do you say to that?
A lot of people say that a person's identity is in their face or in their body, but I was always taught that a person's identity was in their manners and the way they treated people. And I think that if we're realistic, we realize that the way women choose to dress is always influenced by the male attention that it receives. And I choose to deal with men on a moral level instead of in a way that is sexualized or objectified. So I think that actually, instead of hiding us, it actually brings out our true identity.
Do you think, though, that women who are not dressing the same way that you do are, in fact, inviting then sexual attention?
I think that each person has to decide for themselves what their intention is and what their choices are, and I don't push my way onto other people. But I do think women's bodies are used to sell product. They are used to draw sexual attention, and maybe, you know, many women are not doing that on purpose, but because of the society, we're influenced in a way that we don't even realize why we choose to dress the way that we do.
Don't you think that men's bodies are also used in the same way?
I agree, but I don't think it's the same way, because I don't believe that women react to men's bodies the same way that men react to women's bodies. Men are definitely more visual, whereas women are more, it's about emotion. It's definitely, I believe, a different nature. But in Islam, men also have a dress code, and they do also have a modesty.
How do people treat you when they see you dressed in the niqab?
Some people are really negative. I've been flicked off. I've been cussed out. I've been told to go home. And then you have people who smile at me, and I feel they kind of want to tell me, you know, I understand, or I'm okay with you. And at first, I used to get really upset with the stares. And then one day, I was walking through the mall, and I just recently put on the niqab, and I caught a glimpse of myself in a mirror, and I jumped back. And it made me realize that it is something that's shocking. And so it really made me be more understanding.
And what about, I'm wondering where you find it to be most challenging. Have you tried to fly?
Definitely the airports are difficult. I did have an incident where I was pulled off of a plane after we'd boarded. The flight attendants told me to leave with my family and didn't really give us a valid reason why. And it was very embarrassing and very negative, because, maybe the people on the plane thought, oh, wow, they just, stopped another 9/11 or something. And it just really was counter to what I'm about, which is really educating people and showing that we, as Muslims, the majority of us are peace-loving, and we're trying to live as ethically and as morally as we possibly can.
Now, you mentioned that your husband was on his own religious journey, which then made you question your spiritual beliefs and led you to decide to start to wear the niqab. What does he think about you wearing it? Did he ask you to?
No. Actually, I met him in grad school. We graduated. We went our separate paths. He did eventually become Muslim, and he went to Egypt and studied Arabic. And it was during that period that I started to wear the niqab. And then after he came back from Egypt, that's when we, reconnected and married. And I asked him, I said, what is it like for you? And he said, it took some getting used to walking in public with you, because, he's your typical Anglo blonde hair, blue eyed guy. And people look at us, first they look at me in shock, and then they look at him and get totally confused. And then they look at my kids, who look just like him, and they just don't understand how we all fit together. But, obviously he knows that I'm doing this out of my own conviction. And he said it actually pushes him to be better, because he sees how much I have to sacrifice.
You think you have to sacrifice when you dress like this?
When I say I have to sacrifice, it means that I'm not in my comfort zone. I'm not in a place where people understand me. And I do have to constantly, explain myself. I have to go out of my way to be kind to people and to really try to undo the stereotypes that have been out there.
That's Muslim American Hiba Ahmed, who after September 11th decided to start wearing a niqab that covers all of her face except her eyes. In a minute, we'll hear from another Muslim woman who says it's one thing for Hiba to freely choose to cover her face, but many other women don't have a choice. By the way, designers and the European department store Harrods, which is now owned by Qatar's sovereign wealth fund, are selling abayas for their Muslim customers. Abayas used to be simple black robes. No longer. They're sequin, fringed, and pricey, from $5,000 to $10,000. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about the controversy over banning face veils. It's been debated across Europe, and France this month took a step toward a ban. We just spoke with Hiba Ahmed, an American woman who's a practicing Muslim and who, in her 20s, decided to start wearing a niqab, which covers all of her face except her eyes. She says it's increased her confidence and it's been liberating, because she no longer feels that she's constantly being seen in a sexualized way. But our next guest has a different perspective. Egyptian-born Mona El-Tahawi is a practicing Muslim who lives in New York and is a commentator on Muslim identity and gender. And I asked her about Hiba's defense of the niqab.
Hiba sounds to me like an incredibly engaging and warm person, and I could imagine us being friends. But I disagreed with just about every single word she said. It distresses me greatly that she has put this barrier between herself and the rest of the world in the name of a religion that I cherish, that I too practice. I honestly detest the niqab. I detest it because it represents an ideology that, in my opinion, dangerously equates piety with the disappearance of women. I detest it because I believe that the human face is central to communication. Right now, none of us can see each other, so we're all on a level playing field. But if the three of us were in a room together, we would be having a very different conversation if one or two of us had her face covered. I'm very, very sad to hear that, you know, she found it impractical to work while wearing the niqab, because, I mean, it's obvious that it's impractical to work while wearing the niqab, because the niqab presents such a huge barrier. Now, I say all of this as a Muslim woman who wore a headscarf for 9 years. I chose to wear a headscarf, and I chose to take the headscarf off. My mother, who has a PhD in medicine, wears a headscarf. So many of my Muslim women relatives wear headscarves. And so the point about modesty that Heba made several times, I agree, modesty is very important. But where we disagree the most is this definition of modesty. And I'm particularly happy that you brought up this idea of hiding women to prove their worth, because this is exactly the point for me. And I brought up the headscarf because the turning point for me vis-a-vis the niqab happened in Cairo when I was still wearing a headscarf. And I was sitting in the Cairo metro, and a woman in niqab came on. She was dressed in black from head to toe. And she struck up a conversation with me, and I realized that she was trying to convince me to also wear the niqab and cover my face. And I pointed to my headscarf, and I said to her, "Isn't this enough?" And she said, "No, it's not enough, because if you wanted to eat a piece of candy, would you eat a candy that was in a wrapper or a candy that was unwrapped?" And I said to her, "Hold on a minute, I'm not candy, I'm a woman. Women are not candy." And this takes me back to the ideology behind the niqab and why I detest the niqab. Because it's an ideology that portrays women as these precious things that must be hidden to prove their worth. There has been tremendous arguments and interpretation and vigorous interpretations as to exactly what that concept of modesty means for Muslim women. Now, Heber and I read the same Quran. Muslims all over the world read the same Quran. But there are two verses in that Quran, at the Muslim holy book, that address the issue of modesty. And none of them, neither of those two verses, actually say what being modest means. It's what the scholars have done with the two verses. That's where the vigorous interpretation is. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them have said headscarves. A tiny minority of them have said niqab. And when it comes to these discussions of the niqab, it's really important to realize that Islam is not monolithic and not all Muslims think alike.
What about the argument for personal freedom here? There are many folks, including politicians around the world, who have said that they do not support this ban in France because this is a personal matter.
Personal choice is we sometimes illiberally sacrifice personal choice for the greater good, the greater good here being communication at large and social interaction, and what this does to women generally. For every woman like Heba who says she has chosen to cover her face, there are thousands of women who have not chosen to cover their face. And we often hear about the right wing in Europe who have been pushing this ban. For example, in France, it's mostly right-wing politicians who have pushed for this ban, and I detest that right wing because I find that right wing xenophobic, and I find that that right wing basically engages in this caricature of a religion that I cherish very much. But there's another right wing at play here, and this is what I call the Muslim right wing, and this is the ideology that pushes forward this idea of a woman being a precious stone that needs to be covered. And when you think about those thousands of women who do not choose to cover their face, but who are basically pushed by this ideology, it's extremely difficult to stand up to a cleric or a male relative who tells you, if you do not cover every inch of your body from head to toe, you will burn for all eternity. If you want to be a good Muslim woman, this is the choice, so-called choice, that you're given. How do you stand up to an ideology like that?
But there are women like Heba who say, you know, it's my choice. I decide that I want to wear this. I don't feel that it's misogynistic. I actually feel liberated by wearing this.
Again, she has chosen, but there are thousands more who do not have the strength to stand up to the ideology. But also, I lost track of the number of times that Heba used the word sex. There is some kind of obsession here in this ideology that promotes the niqab with sex. She condemns the hypersexualizations, and I agree, you know, that I do not want women's bodies to be used to sell things. But many people condemn this hypersexualization. But the solution is not to disappear women behind the niqab. The solution is to address misogyny. The solution is to address discrimination. And the solution is to ask, why are we telling our 12-year-old and 13-year-old girls that, you know, they should bear their midriff? The solution, though, is not to tell our 12 and 13-year-old girls, you should disappear behind something black. Because the message we're giving them then is, you are nothing but a sex object.
Would you expect that we would have this debate over a so-called burqa ban in the United States?
You can do just about anything in the United States, to be really crude about it, and justify it on religious grounds. And, you know, this is obviously traced back to the history of the United States. You do something, people don't like it, you say, but it's my religious belief, and everybody says, okay, fine, we'll tolerate it. In Europe, it's been almost the opposite, because many European countries spent hundreds of years fighting the influence of the church, a very corrupt influence. And so over there, they almost have this allergy to religious expression. So everything there is centers around the secular. Surely there is a happy medium somewhere. But this is by way of saying, I'm not sure we're going to have this debate in the United States, because in the US, everything is justified on religious accommodation, which is disheartening, I believe.
Mona El-Tahawi is a practicing Muslim and a commentator on issues regarding Muslim identity and gender. Mona, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
In the market for a piece of pristine wilderness with breathtaking views of Wyoming's Teton Range? Well, if the federal government and the state of Wyoming can't agree on a swap of state-owned land and Grand Teton National Park, Wyoming's governor says he'll sell it to the highest bidder. Joining us is Corey Hatch. He covers the environment for the Jackson Hole News and Guide. And Corey, can you explain this federal-state land showdown for us?
Sure. These technically aren't pieces of a national park. They're state-owned in-holdings set aside when the state was founded to benefit Wyoming schools.
So basically, whatever you do to capitalize on that land, whether you sell it, use it for something else, build a school on it, whatever it is, it's supposed to be used for educational purposes.
Exactly.
Okay, and then Grand Teton National Park was established in 1950, which was after the state had these parcels of land. Is that right?
When Grand Teton National Park was founded, the state retained ownership of these parcels.
But they're within the borders of the park.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Now, these are two parcels, each about a square mile. How much is that worth?
An earlier appraisal put the land's worth at about $125 million. The federal government plans another appraisal this summer. Given the recent drop in real estate prices, it's anybody's guess as to how that price will change.
And what's the land used for right now?
Aside from wildlife habitat and its scenic values, there's one rancher who pays the state about $3,000 a year to graze his cattle on one of the parcels.
Is it pretty?
It's beautiful. Mm. Yeah, it's an amazing piece of land surrounded on all sides by mountains. It's pretty stunning.
Now, the governor says he's run out of patience here. The state's been trying to get what it considers fair compensation for this land from the feds. And he says Wyoming's constitution requires that state officials maintain state land for maximum profit. So what does he want?
I toured the site with the governor earlier this year, and he made it clear that he simply wants the issue resolved. I don't think anybody, including the governor, wants to see this land turned into condos. But the federal government has been slow to act, and the state has an obligation to utilize this land to benefit the state schools.
So basically, what is he looking for then? Is he looking for the feds to buy it, to put it in the park, would you say, or what does he want?
I think that's what he wants. He wants the feds to work out some sort of funding scheme so that these pieces of land can become part of Grand Teton National Park.
And is he saying $125 million for this land?
I think they're going to wait and see the results of the most recent appraisal before they settle on a price.
And is there anything else that maybe isn't an exact cash payment right now, but might be an exchange of?
Sure, yeah. I mean, there was a proposal a while back and even a law passed in Congress to do a land swap for those lands with the state for some federal lands that the state might benefit from. And no one could agree on the value of the lands and how much those would be worth. I think the federal government was trying to get rid of some lands that it didn't consider particularly valuable, and the state said, well, if they're not valuable to you, they're not valuable to us either.
So basically, if I have land worth $125 million, don't try to give me land that's not worth anything in exchange.
Exactly.
Now, how are people reacting to this dispute between the governor and the federal government?
I think at this point, there's sort of cautious optimism that the Interior Department is going to come through this time. If the state did put the land up for sale, I'm pretty sure there would be an uproar. People would probably mobilize pretty quickly to preserve the land.
Would you say that this is basically another chapter in the ongoing conflicts over land management between the federal government and some western states?
There's a lot of distrust between state and federal government out here. When the federal government tries to do something on federal lands that the states don't agree with, there's typically sort of an uproar. So there's a different vision for what these lands should be used for. In this case, I think the federal government and the state agree that the best use of this land is to make it part of Grand Teton National Park. They're just not sure how to get the job done.
Corey Hatch, environmental and land use reporter for the Jackson Hole News and Guide, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
There has been a lot of talk about the so-called digital divide and the value of computers for children. Organizations such as One Laptop Per Child, founded by a group from MIT, want to bring a computer to every child in the world. And many countries, including the U.S., are trying to provide computers to school-age children whose families cannot afford them. The assumption is that the computer will help the child in school and prepare them for the workforce. But is that assumption true? Well, a new study shows some surprising results. The study will be published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, and you can find a work draft of it on our website, hereandnow.org. Study co-author Ofer Malamud joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. He's an assistant professor of public policy at the University of Chicago. And Ofer, you looked at two groups of families in Romania, and these are low-income families, very similar to one another, except some got vouchers to buy computers and some did not. What did you find with the kids who got a computer?
We find both positive and negative effects. On the negative side, we see that kids who received a computer actually had lower academic achievement in terms of grades in math, in Romanian, and in English. On the positive side, we see evidence of increased computer skills. There's also some suggestive evidence that kids with computers had higher cognitive skills.
What does that mean, higher cognitive skills? How did you measure that exactly?
That's a very good question. We basically used a test called the Ravens Progressive Matrices Test. It's basically an IQ test, which requires kids to match a certain pattern to a missing area of the sheet. These are, of course, all tests given without the use of computers. We didn't want to confuse the findings. There's a big argument among psychologists about what these tests actually measure, whether it's a pure cognitive component or a more of a spatial dimension. I think there's probably a mixture of both, but this is still, I think, an area of discussion among psychologists.
Which is why you said it was suggestive, really, some
suggestive
yes, that's right. evidence, right? But in terms of the academic achievement, that was not suggestive at all.
No, we found quite big reductions. They were statistically significant and quite big. And I guess this is not good news.
It's my understanding that these computers did not have internet access.
That's right. This is basically the effect of a home computer generally without internet access. And what the kids were doing, it turns out, was they were mostly playing games.
Which, of course, they would, right?
Yes. That's certainly what I did when I received my first computer
right.
at age 14. The Romanian government had intended this program to have a strong educational component. They actually made a variety of educational software available to kids to install on their computers. It seems that basically families did not install this educational software, and those that did didn't end up using it very much. And I think that says something about whether one needs a structured environment in order to use the computer in an effective way. For many families, there was no such structured environment at home.
So did you find a difference if parents did set very clear rules about computer use, if that helped?
Yes. We actually asked parents whether they set rules regarding homework or rules regarding computer use, and we find that this really mattered. Parents who set rules about homework, the children did not have quite as big reductions in their academic achievement, and those parents who set rules about computer use actually didn't have quite as large positive effects on computer skills. So parents certainly matter. We do want to be a little bit careful about whether these effects are really due to rules. The parents who impose rules may be different on other dimensions as well. They'd just be more conscientious parents. But certainly parents matter. I think that's one of the conclusions we can draw from this study.
And maybe playing games on the computer can be good for kids in some ways.
Certainly. That is actually one of the findings that surprised us, that despite the fact that they played so many games, they had increases in computer skills and a measure of cognitive or spatial ability. And this is consistent, I think, with some of the literature in psychology that have shown playing computer games can increase certain types of skills.
You said a study about television use and watching in the United States when TV was relatively new, and that study showed that there was not a significant effect in kids' test scores. Is that right?
That's right. This is actually a study by some colleagues of mine at the Booth School of Business. They conducted a study looking at the introduction of television, and they find that there was not much of a negative effect on children's test scores as has been previously assumed. And I think that's further evidence that introduction of media does not always have corrupting effects on children and adolescents.
So does that suggest that there's something different going on here with a computer versus a TV?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that there's certainly differences in the level of interactivity. We've not done a sort of a perfect side-by-side comparison, but certainly we see, rather than no effects on outcomes, we see very mixed effects, so some positive and some negative with computers. An interesting area for further research is to try to see what are the effects later on in terms of educational attainment, in terms of wages and labor market outcomes. That's something that we can't say yet, but we certainly hope to follow up on this cohort of children, adolescents, and learn more.
Is the basic conclusion, would you say, maybe we should hold off on giving kids computers, or we definitely need to have strong parental controls when computers are introduced into a home? Or what are, you know, I know you said parents matter, but what are sort of the big general conclusions that you think we can take from your study?
I think I would say that in providing home computers, one needs to be very aware about what the computers are used for. Certainly there were some important benefits regardless of whether the kids played games or not. But I think it would be helpful to provide more guidance to parents about how to monitor and supervise their kids effectively, and also perhaps bundle in educational software directly with a computer so that it's more available and more accessible to kids to use. Ultimately, of course, there's only so much we can do to control what children do with a computer.
Ofer Malamud is assistant professor of public policy at the University of Chicago. He's been talking with us about the study that he and his colleague Christian Papalechis did on the effects of computer use on low-income children. Ofer, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We want to take a look now at some of today's headlines. Oil prices are up as energy producers keep an eye on the tropical storm heading toward the Gulf. Benchmark crude and natural gas prices are up, but prices at the pump are unchanged. The national average price for a gallon of regular unleaded gas is $2.71. Mortgage rates are down. Freddie Mac said today that rates fell for the fourth time in 5 weeks. The average rate for a 30-year fixed loan is 4.56%. That's the lowest since Freddie Mac began tracking rates in 1971, and the last time that loan rates were lower was during the 1950s. Just ahead, a rose farm is reborn. You're listening to Here and Now. An update now on a story we brought you 2 summers ago when the last rose farm in New England closed because of foreign competition. Well, it's back in business. For the past year, Pinchbeck's Rose Farm in Guilford, Connecticut, has been partnering with autism advocates in a program called Roses for Autism. It allows people with autism, who often have difficulty interacting with others, to receive state-supported job training. And the farm gets to stay open. Here and Now's Lynn Menegon recently went back to find out how the farm and its workers are doing.
A handful of cattle are the first thing a visitor sees when arriving at Pinchbeck's Rose Farm. Owner Tom Pinchbeck calls them grass cutters and an occasional source of protein. He's often repairing the barbed wire fence, but sometimes one animal gets away.
Turned out to be the bull. He's nice and gentle, but he was all revved up, so he was prancing around on the guy's yard.
That's life in small-town New England, where Pinchbeck Farms and its two enormous greenhouses have been a part of the landscape since Tom's grandfather started back in 1929. Tom knows many of his customers by name.
Harold, how are you? Good.
The idea of roses for autism was brought to Tom by way of Jim Lyman, whose family also owns a farm in Connecticut. Lyman said he had many sleepless nights wondering what his severely autistic son Eli would be able to do for work once he graduated from school.
That started me really to take a look at what was out there for vocational programs, and what I found was there really isn't much. And so in doing that, talked with various parents, and what the common denominator seemed to be was the agrarian lifestyle.
So Tom Pinchbeck found a way for people with autism and his greenhouses to flower.
A year ago, this time of the year, we were pruning back. And
right now it's filled with totally living
plants. It's all back. Yeah, it all came back pretty quickly.
So what's brought it all back?
Well, it's this program with Ability Beyond Disability.
They're autism advocates.
They saw the possibilities of bringing the greenhouse back and using it as a vocational training ground, really, is what it is. And we were trying to teach not only agricultural-specific jobs, but just what it takes to have a job. You know, you can't come and go as you please. You have somebody who is your supervisor. You need to report to them when you're done. You need to be able to stay focused. There's lots of things that cut across any type of job that we can train here.
So let's walk along and see what kind of jobs would your autism people be doing?
One of the first jobs that we'll do here is we want to put a little bit of fertilizer in the pot. It's as simple as walking through and putting a teaspoon's worth of fertilizer in the bucket, but not all that difficult. But
you can't put two or three, or you can't.
You don't want to put
one.
Too much in, and hopefully you don't skip one, and you don't want to slosh it all over on the ground because then it just encourages weed growth.
Right.
Another item is, well, it's almost like deadheading, but it's even before the flower has bloomed. We pop the little buds off to encourage more foliar growth.
More leaves?
More leaf, yep.
So it's painstaking work.
That's right. One of the advantages we have is, you know, you can get the job coach to help you do some work, and that job coach is being paid through state funding.
Explain how that works. You're not left alone to fend for yourself and learn a skill in a, you know, new environment. You've got someone helping you.
No, that's right. You see a lot of this stuff. You know,
the placards stuck to the fences. Oh, these are instructions, which is a new addition to your farm because it's specifically for the autistic workers,
you know,
a little extra help
here.
It's a cheat sheet.
In different ways. It's a cheat sheet right as you sort of wander by as a reminder. Cut the rose at the certain size head and then where to cut the rose on the stem. I've seen success stories come through. The person I'm thinking of in particular is college age and is going to the college in Maine. And he was our first employee, and I consider that a success. He's moving on. He's going to
college.
Yeah, right.
Matt Radler has been working at Pinchbeck's farm for a little over a year. As the big station wagon-sized rose sorting machine finishes its job, cutting and transporting roses one by one along a conveyor belt in baguette-sized troughs, Matt tells me how he does his job.
I've been grading, packaging, making deliveries, doing maintenance kind of stuff.
And graded roses means?
They're sorted by length.
And right now you're counting the roses.
Yeah, I'm putting them in dozens for sale.
And this is like a potato masher.
Yeah, it is a potato masher.
To do what?
Some customers like when we take the leaves off the bottom of the roses, so we use a potato masher to do it.
Clipping the bottom of the roses, you're putting a rubber band on them.
Mm-hmm. And then you put them in a sleeve for selling. I got this job in the first place because I literally couldn't find anything else. I've never been good at listening to direction.
Do you think that's because of the autism?
That has nothing to do with autism. My spectrum issues are more along the lines of organization, than any, like, interpersonal skills or stuff like that.
That's good that you know that.
Yeah, well, it took me a while to actually accept that it was an issue.
So what was the biggest challenge for you here at Roses for Autism?
Well, 6 or 7 months ago, we got a new retail manager named Lori, and I didn't really like her at first. Kind of resented her coming in here and telling me how to do my job after I'd been here for like 6 months already. You know?
So did anybody help you with that from the program?
No, I just decided to suck it up eventually. And I mean, I ended up liking her after a while. I think that was pretty much the first time in my life where I actually accepted somebody else telling me what to do when I didn't think they should be.
Longtime Pinchbeck Farm employee Cliff Carter says he's noticed the difference in Matt.
After a while, I did notice tremendous improvement taking instruction. And, you know, I found he's a smart kid, so I think that's part of the problem, that he gets bored if you come back tomorrow and try to show him the same thing, because if you found out, he already got it. You know? I think he'll do well if he carry this obedience to another place.
So this is a new element in all your years here at the farm. This is a new thing for you to be training workers who have maybe a couple of special challenges.
Yes, at first I didn't know what to expect, but each of them is on a different level. Each of them is unique in their own way, a different level, and it takes them a while to catch things. But you found out that eventually all of them improve.
It's $34.98 with the tax, please.
As customers call and come in to buy flowers, job coach Emily Sedera shares her perspective.
There are challenges and there are difficulties, but our motto is no failure.
There is no failure.
There is no failure here. We do everything to help our individuals succeed as well as for us to succeed.
And your change is $2.05.
So as the farm continues to ramp up production, with an eye towards eventually making a profit, one thing seems certain. Local customers like Tacey Woods are glad the Rose Farm is back.
Very happy. Yeah, we always came here for the roses because they had a scent unlike most roses that you find in the stores, you know, that are imported. They were just beautiful. Yeah.
Now, they're doing something special here, something really unique.
I know, it sounded like a perfect kind of partnership. I say we were really happy both to have Pinchbeck's back and to see this kind of work being done.
Right into these containers here.
Here and now's Lynn Menegon at Pinchbeck's Rose Farm in Guilford, Connecticut. For more information about Roses for Autism, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.